Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A winter storm is coming. Expect snow and ice in the mountains, and Charlotte may see its first measurable snowfall in years. We detail the forecast. The GOP-controlled North Carolina Supreme Court stops the certification of the vote in a race for one of their own members. Newly minted Governor Josh Stein issues more executive orders, and new Attorney General Jeff Jackson sues landlords for illegally raising rents. And our new General Assembly is underway, promising more Hurricane Helene relief. And in sports, a strong, possibly hopeful ending to the Panthers season. Here to talk about all those stories and more is WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. Ben Thompson is anchor at WCNC-TV. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning to you all. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All week, we have been hearing the warning winter is coming, or more accurately, snow is coming. Yesterday, schools around the area announced that they would be canceling classes today because of the forecast, and one of those voices sounding the alarm has been WCNC Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich. So since this storm could bring Charlotte its first measurable snowfall in many years, we start with Brad. Brad, good morning. Thank you for being here. What's the latest?
Yeah, good morning. It's been a while. It's been almost exactly 3 years since we've had measurable snow in Charlotte. And I always like to preface it. It's supposed to snow in Charlotte, by the way. We average about 3.5 inches of snow per winter. The fact that we haven't had snow for the last 2 seasons plus was the anomaly, because that was the first time in recorded history we had 2 straight years with zero snow. So this is kind of a big deal from that standpoint. But from a regular winter storm standpoint, this is kind of what we typically would see. We've got snow and the dreaded sleet and freezing rain, that mix. We rarely get all snow here, but this will start as snow later this afternoon, and it will be a daytime event. So another rarity for us, we actually get to see it fall. And that's why a lot of schools and businesses have closed early, because around here, when you mix winter weather and the rush hour, especially a Friday evening rush hour, it tends to cause some havoc. So I expect the snow will pick up mid-afternoon, could start a little bit after lunchtime. We're getting some early reports this morning already. About 4 inches of snow in Atlanta this morning, 4 to 5 inches around Atlanta, snowing in Augusta, Georgia right now, and Columbia, South Carolina. So It's pretty far south that we're getting the snow reports. And so it's just a matter of time before it gets up here. But I would caution you that it's not going to be all snow. We will get a lot of sleet. And sleet, if you're not familiar, it's the frozen raindrops. It's not freezing rain, which falls into liquid. This is the kind that pings around and makes all the noise. And that usually causes really big havoc on the roads, because it doesn't melt as easily as snow when it hits pavement or concrete. And so I expect the roads will be really icy. As you probably are aware of, it's been really cold this week. Ground temperatures and road temperatures are about as cold as I've seen them in a long time, in the low 30s. So this is going to stick almost immediately.
I was watching you yesterday, because you're one of my house's always on appliances, because you're always on online. And I was watching, and you said, don't expect a winter wonderland out of this storm. What did that mean?
Well, because it's not going to be all snow, and it's not going to be that idyllic snow, like Hallmark movie kind of look. It's going to be more kind of ugly looking, because the sleet and ice is going to make it stick to everything. So it might not look really fluffy white snow, but the roads will be horrendous. I think you'll almost get like glacier type snowpack, because what happens is you get the snow first, you get sleet on top of that, and then the freezing rain acts like, you know, Krispy Kreme donut glaze and glazes it all over and creates this like hard packed ice that is going to be the problem. And so that's not really beautiful looking. It's just horrible on the roads.
So if it's snowing in Augusta and it's snowing in Columbia, but it's not snowing here yet, at least as I look out the window, it's not snowing here yet. How much accumulation are we likely to get, and what areas of Charlotte, our listening area, will get the most?
Well, I think everybody gets at least an inch or two. The tough part about accumulations is anytime it starts sleeting, it cuts down the snow totals. But sleet does count as snow because it accumulates. It just takes a lot more of it to add up. Snow is 90% air, so it takes just a little bit of liquid to fluff up snow. sleet is a 1-to-1 ratio. So a tenth of an inch of liquid would be a tenth of an inch of sleet. Whereas if it's a tenth of an inch of liquid to snow, that's a whole inch of snow. So there's some mixing in there that's going to cause the totals to probably be lower than you think, even though it could snow and sleet for several hours this evening. So 1 to 2 inches of snow or sleet accumulation with probably a tenth or maybe even a quarter inch of ice on top of that. And that's freezing rain. So, you know, all in all, this is that really bad mess that you don't want to see this time of year. And the mountains in the foothills, they'll get more snow than us, Mike, but not as much as you normally think. This system's coming from the southwest. So the areas with the highest totals could be towards the upstate of South Carolina, southwestern North Carolina, like Andrews, Murphy, west of Asheville. Those areas would end up getting more snow than, say, like Boone or Jefferson.
And when you talk about a tenth of an inch of ice to a quarter of an inch of ice, the tenth of an inch isn't going to really be all that much of a problem or a threat, I should say, to the power infrastructure. Yeah. But a quarter of an inch of ice is when we start having problems with tree limbs and power lines, correct?
Yep, exactly. Quarter inch is kind of the threshold where that's enough weight to bring a branch or cause a power line to sag. So when we start seeing quarter inch and above, we start worrying about power outages. And the area that would probably be most susceptible to that would be areas in South Carolina. So think of areas like Chester, Union County, South Carolina, maybe York, Lancaster, those areas down there. Now, we got to keep an eye on that because that's an area of South Carolina as well, down towards the upstate that was heavily damaged by Helene. So you got a lot of tree damage down there already from Helene's winds back in September of last year. So there could be more damage than we normally would see from an ice event because so many weakened limbs and branches and trees already from the damage Helene caused just several months ago.
There are meteorological reasons why we have sleet versus freezing rain. What is the difference and which is more troublesome for people who are trying to drive on the road, sleet or freezing rain?
Sleet, honestly, because it tends to accumulate real quickly on the road surfaces. Freezing rain can be a problem if the road surface is cold enough. The difference between the two is freezing rain actually falls as a liquid. It's like going out this morning when it's 28 degrees and turning your garden hose on and spraying it all over your driveway and then watching it freeze after the fact. Sleet is actually like going to your ice box right now and grabbing crushed ice in your freezer and throwing it out on the ground. It's already frozen. It's hard. It's going to hit the ground, bounce around, but it piles up pretty quickly. And so that can be a problem, especially when cars drive over it. They pack it down and creates, and to me, the worst is when you get together, you get them both together because then they both freeze up and you get a big block of ice. So that's what we're expecting today. And Mike, it's kind of rare that our road surfaces are so cold because we've been in the teens the last couple of nights and we don't normally have the road surfaces and the ground, the soil temperature so cold when we get these events. We often get a lot of snow, but it melts almost instantly on contact. I mean, I've covered a ton of events here where it snowed all day and it never accumulated because the ground was so warm, it just melted. That's not the case in this go around. We've got really cold refrigerated ground. So the first flakes and sleet pellets are going to stick immediately.
Driving in snow is difficult for a lot of people, particularly since we don't have snow tires in this area in general, or even chains. But driving in ice is impossible everywhere, and we don't get a lot of that. And so it becomes a challenge for drivers in our area. NCDOT's Mike Mariano offered some advice to drivers.
Never turn on your cruise control. Obviously, you want to gradually slow down and don't slam on your brakes. And then obviously use caution. When you're going across bridges or overpasses, make sure you're slowing down and just giving yourself plenty of time to get where you're going.
And he added that even though the storm will be gone by tomorrow afternoon, according to the National Weather Service, NCDOT plans to continue to monitor road conditions.
We're going to be watching it close. We'll probably still have trucks out monitoring any of those spot locations that we may get some bleed through the pavement or just some areas that still have some moisture on the road.
So fortunately for us, Brad, when it snows here, at least most of the time when it snows here, it's if it snows at 8 o'clock in the morning, it's gone by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you don't have to do a lot of shoveling. Sometimes you do, but not often. What's going to be the case with this weather calamity?
Well, I think some of it will melt Saturday because while it won't be super warm Saturday, it's going to get above freezing. We'll probably be close to 40 degrees and the sun will eventually come out. So that will do a little bit of the work for us. But as you just heard from DOT, we're probably going to get a refreeze Saturday night into Sunday morning. So we'll get the black ice that returns. In my experience, generally, they do a really good job on the main roads just because they treat them so much and there's so much traffic on them to kind of clear them naturally. It's those side streets, the neighborhood roads that really stay kind of ice covered for a couple nights after the event. So I would expect that we'll probably have some issues Sunday morning. And honestly, we might have a few isolated pockets Monday morning as people try to go back to work and school, where it's not widespread, but there's some patchy black ice that could cause some issues there. Maybe even I could see delays for some school districts maybe on Monday morning just because of that.
So this unusual winter weather event, and becoming increasingly unusual for this area, because I heard people in Canada saying, come on up, it's not as cold as it used to be.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the fact that this is happening at the same time that they just released information that 2024 was once again the warmest year on record, and alarmingly so, evidently.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times when we get these events, people go, you know, how could there be warming going on when we're getting an event? Well, you still get cold air. And one of the side effects of a warming Arctic is that it displaces the cold air south. One of the weird things about the polar vortex, which gets a lot of buzz this time of year, is when cold air spills into the U.S., it's because the polar vortex is weaker, not stronger. When it weakens, it spills cold air south. And that happens when there's warming in the Arctic. So when you get warming in high latitudes like the Arctic Ocean, it actually forces cold air out of the Arctic to the south. And that's when we tend to get big outbreaks. But they're fewer and farther in between. Yeah, we're getting snow right now. But as we mentioned at the top, this is the first time in 3 years that had never happened before. And to me, snow is like the canary in the coal mine for us because it's easy, it's visual, it's very memorable. The fact that we've gone 3 full years with zero snow for the first time in our 146 years of record keeping here really tells you how warm the winters are getting. But I think because people don't like cold weather as much, they don't notice it, that it's getting milder. But the fact that it's not snowing as much really tells you that there's something going on, that we are getting warmer.
And there are these two weather phenomena that originate in the Pacific, the La Nina and the El Nino. And we are about to enter, I think a little late for the year, but we're about to enter this La Nina effect. What does that mean for our weather in this area?
So typically in a La Nina winter, we would be dry and warm. And we have been dry. It's been below average for precipitation, but it's not been super cold, but it's not been mild either. It's been kind of normal. December was pretty close to average, which tells you something. If you thought it was really cold, that's actually what it's supposed to be. That kind of tells you how warm it's been the last couple of years. But January's actually been off to a pretty cold start, which is kind of weird. You know, typically we would see it kind of a milder winter. The other side effect of La Nina is we tend to get more severe weather. And we did see that in December. We had two tornadoes touch down in the winter time here, or just one west of the airport on the 29th of December. So that's another calling card of La Nina. We tend to get more wintertime severe weather because usually there's warmer air trying to surge up to the north, intersecting that winter jet stream, and we tend to see some severe weather. What's interesting is the La Nina hasn't really taken off yet. We're kind of stuck in neutral. There is a phase in between El Nino and La Nina called the neutral phase. We jokingly call it La Nada because it's in between. But we're kind of stuck there right now. And so we'll have to see if we transition to La Nina as we get into the coming weeks and months as we go into this new year.
So I have 30 seconds, Brad. Give us the start and stop times on this winter event.
I would say be where you want to be by mid-afternoon because the combination of snow and sleet falling, and then everybody, you know how it is, Mike, everyone will leave work at the same time when those flakes start flying, and it'll be gridlock out there. And just the traffic alone will cause issues. So be ready by about 3 or 4 o'clock. The sun sets at 5:30, and that's when it really gets bad.
Brad Panovich is chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV. Thank you for joining us. We're coming back with the news roundup in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News, along with Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast, and two luminaries of the television media network. Hunter Sines is with us. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Steve, with this winter storm approaching and the expected dropping of snow and ice and sleet here and in the mountains, newly minted Governor Josh Stein wasted no time in issuing an executive order to keep North Carolina warm. It was executive order number 6 for him. Why did he feel the need to issue it?
Yeah, the governor did this really, in a way, in response to obviously the winter storm, but also Hurricane Helene from the fall. And what the order does, it will waive the limits for truck drivers to bring propane and other heating fuels to people around the state. If they are bringing those materials, they are allowed to drive longer and farther just to make sure people stay warm.
And this, as I said, is executive order number 6 in a very short administration, which began essentially this week. It comes on the heels of 5 Hurricane Helene recovery executive orders that he issued on his second day in office. Are these just a continuation of what Governor Cooper had been doing, or is this some sort of new thinking, new initiative?
I believe this is basically a continuation of former Governor Cooper's actions.
About 12,000 people in the hurricane-affected areas of North Carolina are without safe housing. 8,000 private roads and bridges need repair. The first two orders address those needs. The third order creates the Governor's Recovery Office for Western North Carolina, or something called GRO-NC, which is now a division within the Office of the Governor for the next year. And another executive order establishes a Governor's Advisory Committee on how to meet needs quickly and cost-effectively. Yet another executive order grants 16 additional hours of leave for state employees who volunteer for storm-related efforts. So a flurry of activity in the opening days of the Stein administration. The question about who won a seat on the North Carolina State Supreme Court continues, despite several bipartisan recounts that show incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs leading her Republican challenger Jefferson Griffin by 734 votes. Griffin and the GOP are also challenging the validity of 60,000 votes from the November election. Now, it went before a federal judge. He sent it to the state Supreme Court to decide. This week, that high court stopped the State Board of Elections from certifying Riggs' win. So first, Steve and Ben and Mary, I'm not sure which one of you to ask this question of, what are the questions swirling around the validity of those 60,000 votes?
Well, they're saying that, Steve, did you want to answer?
Go, Mary.
No, go for it,
Mary. That the registrations are lacking driver's license numbers or the last 4 digits of the Social Security number. But it is kind of unprecedented because they have not shown that there is one illegal or fraudulent vote out of these 60,000. And presumably all of these people showed up and they gave ID and they showed it and they voted. So their votes were counted as legal. But that is why they're doing this. Now, this is a legal theory that's been floated and actually rejected even by right-wing organizations like the so-called Election Integrity Network that has said when we win elections, everything goes fine. When Republicans lose them, they have to fight because the voting system was rigged.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, state law does not require folks to give their driver's license number or their social security number, which is what's at stake right here, unlike, say, voter ID or something like that. It also raises much bigger questions about the State Board of Elections and if this puts a stain on them. And what does it mean for the other races? This lawsuit strictly applies to this, but I mean, if 60,000 votes were not good for this race, why would that not be applied to all the other myriad races that appeared on November's ballot? Because all of those races at this point have been certified. Because also keep in mind one other thing, that one of the requirements to run for office in the state of North Carolina is that you are a registered voter. Well, some of the people that are on this 60,000 person list are newly elected officials. So it calls into question their races as well.
And what about that, Steve? If the court decides that the 60,000 votes are going to be thrown out, Won't the Democrats and the Republicans fight over the winners in these other contests? Whose votes, the vote count for them would obviously have to change in the absence of these 60,000 votes.
Yeah, Ben's right. I mean, on the 60,000 list, there are a handful of elected officials. And presumably, if they're not, as he said, if they're not eligible to vote, they're not eligible to serve. I think that, you know, we talk about things like a crisis. We use those words often, but I think this is an instance when that word isn't being overused about what could potentially be happening. Now, this week, the court did amend its order. You know, they had put in an order to prevent the state board from certifying the race for at least 2 weeks. Soon after that, the court did amend its order. One Republican justice, Richard Dietz, did join the Democratic dissent in saying, look, this is not a good thing. This would, you know, call into question all sorts of future elections. And another Republican justice wrote that just because he sided with the stay doesn't mean that he's going to vote to prevent certification. Now, if they all vote that way, it would be a 3-3 deadlock, and Allison Riggs would eventually be declared the winner.
It's interesting, too, though. Allison Riggs' parents, I think, are on this list of people who are ineligible because of this. And I think that some of the reaction with Dietz and other Republican judges sort of saying, well, we doesn't mean we're going to throw it out, is because the reaction to this nationally has been pretty shocking. People are writing about it. ProPublica had an article about it, that this really is a totally different way of looking at elections and deciding elections. And just because they're close, remember Sherry Beasley lost by 400 votes and she didn't contest it. Sometimes they're close elections and you might come out on the one end of it or the other.
You can go online and look for the list and look for your name on that list. And I did yesterday. It took a while because the list is 1,200 or more pages long. That's how many people we're talking about, single-spaced around the state. Anita Earls, who is a Democrat on the Supreme Court, wrote that she dissented in this decision because there is no likelihood of this suit having any success and that the court should not interfere with the ordinary course of the democratic process. The Republican that you referred to, Justice Richard Dietz, who also dissented to this, pointed to concerns over litigation that seeks to rewrite, this is a quote, our state's election rules, and as a result, remove the right to vote in an election from people who already lawfully voted under the existing rules. He says that this invites incredible mischief. That's a quote. So they've given this stay for 2 weeks. What is supposed to happen that hasn't already happened in the next 2 weeks?
Both sides are going to present briefs, present their arguments to the court, and then presumably the court will make a decision. And like I said before, if it is a 3-3 deadlock, then the state board will be allowed to move forward and certify Riggs as the winner.
A lot of ink is being spilled by columnists and editorialists in newspapers around the state and around the country, actually, about this. And it leads to a question that I think is a legitimate question to be asked. We don't talk about the guy who's bringing the charges, Jefferson Griffin. He's a judge. He's trying to be a Supreme Court justice. He's doing this with the help of the state GOP. Talk to me about who he is and what his background is. What do we know about him? Is this because he legitimately believes that there could be shenanigans going on in this election with this vote? Or is this just more Republican machinations to try to queer our elections, for lack of a better word?
The state GOP did, back in the fall, challenge, it was about 225,000 voters overall before the election who had these similar problems with missing driver's license numbers or social security numbers. Federal Judge Myers, who also ruled in this case, threw that case out. So this has been Republicans have been looking at this line of attack for a while. But again, to what Justice Dietz said, this is something that should have been litigated and decided before the election, not after. And it was. It was decided that those voters are eligible to vote. And he was saying, look, we can't come back now after the election and try and change the rules that we all agreed on.
Ben.
I don't have an answer for you, Mike. I have a question, though. I'm hoping Steve can answer. What happens, take this to its furthest point, what happens then? Because, I mean, you've got lots of Republicans on this list of 60,000 people. You've got lots of unaffiliated. I mean, the ramifications this could have, if say, the Supreme Court rules with him, then does that mean anything for any of the other races, even those that those have been certified? What does it mean going forward, I guess, is what I'm trying to wonder.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think presumably, right, if you eliminate all these voters from the pool, that would change the results of other races. Another thing, too, the 60,000 represents people who voted either by mail or early in person, because those ballots are retrievable. We can pull them out. There are other people who voted on Election Day who also have this missing information. Their votes would be allowed to stand under the Republican argument because we can't retrieve them, which is just another question. You would be allowing some, allegedly invalid ballots to count and others not. I don't understand really how that is particularly fair, but I think the Republicans and Griffin feel like, well, 60,000, if you eliminate 60,000, that's enough to get them over the finish line.
Mary.
And I think that if he had won the election, you would not have seen this challenge. And we can all say that. So this is something, the reason you're seeing articles all around the country is because these kinds of teams are in place all over the country. And they were ready if Trump had lost the election to bring these kinds of lawsuits in states all around the country and pretty much not accept the results of the election if they were to lose. Now, the fact that they won, they're fine with it. So I think people are right in questioning the selectivity of using this particular tactic and just trying to, just get enough votes so that you'll be in the winner's column. And that's something that we have to look at.
So to be clear, Allison Riggs, the incumbent, the Democratic incumbent, is leading Jefferson Griffin by 734 votes. And that has been the case after multiple bipartisan recounts of these votes. That's a tight margin of victory in a big state with a lot of people. But Steve, is it unprecedented? Is 734 votes unprecedented?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, Mary just mentioned 4 years ago in another race for the state Supreme Court, Sherry Beasley lost her seat to Republican Paul Newby by, 401 votes or 451?
400, yeah.
I mean, and she went through two recounts, the kind of the statewide machine recount and then the sample hand recount. She tried to win, but once that was over, then she conceded. And we reached that point in the Griffin Riggs race, and Griffin has kept going.
And correct me if I'm wrong, what would be unprecedented would be throwing out 60,000 votes, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
Yes, particularly since they haven't even pointed out one vote that they said was fraudulent or illegal, not one.
Yeah, not one. If the high court decides in Griffin's favor, would it be fair to say that our state Supreme Court has become another arm of the Republican Party and another nail in the coffin of the rule of law?
Some people are saying that they already are, but that's some people.
Okay. I just think Governor Josh Stein, even without that, I think it has such broad implications about future races and the current races and what it means going forward.
Governor Josh Stein was sworn in on January 1st. He'll be officially inaugurated tomorrow, Saturday. Meanwhile, the new General Assembly began their legislative long session on Wednesday. The House has a new speaker since Tim Moore now serves in Congress. And Destin Hall, the new speaker, used his opening remarks to outline his priorities, including the one that he sees as the top priority, rebuilding Western North Carolina in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene.
It's going to be a long road to recovery. This more than $50 billion probably in damage, but this body is committed to doing everything possible to build back Western North Carolina and build it back stronger than before.
And as we mentioned, Governor Stein focused his first six executive orders on hurricane-stricken Western North Carolina and their recovery efforts. The state's rainy day fund evidently has been heavily dinged by Helene. Have they discussed a dollar figure, Steve, on these efforts?
I have not. I believe they have, but I'm not certain of that at the moment. But to your point about the rainy day fund, I mean, it has been it has been depleted. That's what it's for emergencies, and a big part of the legislature about not only will it be spending money to help Western North Carolina, but also finding money to replenish that fund.
In odd years, the legislature holds their long session. This is an odd year during which most of the work is supposed to get done. What else appears to be on the legislative agenda?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big thing will be passing a two-year budget. That's proven very difficult in the past, even though Republicans have, you know, majorities in both houses. You know, there are some other unfinished business kind of hanging over from previous sessions. Medical marijuana is one. Whether to allow for casinos is another. Those two issues could come up. But the budget will be a big deal. And then here locally for Charlotte, Charlotte wants legislators to approve their 1 cent sales tax for transit. They've kind of gone all in on doing that this session. So we'll see if they get any traction.
And as we said on an earlier program this week, there is no backup plan if the legislature says no to our transit dreams. The two left undone issues that come from the previous session, medical marijuana and casinos, both of those were held up or defeated in the House. They were Senate bills that were passed in the Senate. What is the likelihood of the change of leadership in the House to Destin Hall for their passage? Does it change their prospects in any way?
I'm not sure if it does for either one. You know, these are kind of two issues that are, you know, for a lot of House members, they kind of veer into kind of moral or, you know, issues. And I think a lot of people are going to have difficult approving marijuana and casinos. The marijuana issue, I just find interesting because, you know, North Carolina is a very restrictive state on marijuana. We have no medical marijuana, but basically the same thing is sold legally all over the state, all over Charlotte. And it's, we kind of, you know, have these like endless battles over medical marijuana, but all of these nearly identical intoxicating products are sold very easily.
Yeah, and we had an incident in Charlotte, I think in the last year, at a bus stop where the police could not tell the difference between legally sold materials and what constitutes illegally possessed materials. A couple of things to talk about with regard to the legislature going forward, and that is the new players in town and how they might interact and how that may or may not change the dynamics. Plus, Attorney General Jeff Jackson already getting off to a quick start, and Duke Energy replacing coal-fired plants with gas, something that people seemed to like at one time, but now maybe not so much. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here, our political reporter at WFAE News. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. And Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Don Bumgardner Vaughn, who covers Jones Street for the Raleigh News and Observer, wrote recently, Steve, that although our new governor and Senate leader Phil Berger have known each other for years, Stein and the new House Speaker Destin Moore don't know each other well. How might that change the dynamics between the executive and legislative branches in this upcoming session? You're muted, Steve. Unmute yourself.
I apologize. I was on mute. I think they will both be kind of right, trying to get to know each other and trying to figure out where they can find common ground. I think another thing that's interesting to watch will be, you know, we've talked about how the Democrats have broken the Republican supermajority by one seat in the House. But just as 2 years ago, then Speaker Tim Moore talked about having a working supermajority, Destin Hall has said the same thing. There are a handful of Democratic House members who are kind of moderate to conservative Democrats who do vote with Republicans sometimes. One of those is Carla Cunningham of Mecklenburg County. Cecil Brockman of Guilford County is another. So, you know, the Democrats will have a difficult time again keeping all members of their caucus voting in lockstep.
It's one thing when Democrats vote with Republicans when they have a supermajority, which enables them to override any and all gubernatorial vetoes. It's another when they don't have that supermajority and it takes Democrats to cross the aisle to override a veto. If that happens, and when that happens, because it will probably, how will the party, how will the governor view those Democrats that crossed the aisle?
Well, we'll see how Josh Stein handles that. Under Governor Cooper, he did not tolerate dissent, did not have, there was a famous case a few years ago when he backed a primary challenge to a Democratic state senator, Kirk Diviere, in Cumberland County, and he lost. So Cooper did not tolerate dissent much at all. It'll be interesting to see how Stein kind of uses his bully pulpit and his role as leader of the party to try and keep Democrats voting with Democrats.
The supermajority has been broken, but it's only slightly broken. But what would happen if these 60,000 votes that we're talking about in the state Supreme Court race were thrown out? Would that change the balance? If you have to have new elections or recount the votes without these 60,000 people, what might that do to the balance of power in the legislature?
Well, there were several close races. I'm not sure. You know, in Mecklenburg County, Tricia Cotham defeated Nicole Sidman in her race by about 200 votes. If you threw out the 60,000, would that change that result? Perhaps. There were other close races statewide that helped Democrats break the supermajority. Would there be enough votes to change that? I'm not sure if there are in any of the House races, but as Ben said earlier, I mean, there would clearly be other races statewide that would alter the result, no doubt.
Well, it's time to bring Hunter into this conversation. Hunter Sines from WSSC-TV. Wasting no time, Hunter, our new Attorney General Jeff Jackson has filed a lawsuit. He did it on Tuesday against six landlords for allegedly working together and with the software company RealPage to raise North Carolinians' rent. Jackson's only been in office for a week. This obviously must be something that was underway in the previous administration, correct?
It was, yes. This just expanded the previous lawsuit that also included RealPage, but now this includes far more apartment management companies.
Yeah, Graystar Real Estate Partners, Blackstone, LiveCore, Cushman & Wakefield, Pinnacle Property Management Services, Willow Bridge Property Company, and Cortland Management. What kinds of properties do they manage? Are these single-family homes? Are these mid-rise apartment complex? What are they?
A majority of them are one, two-bedroom apartments, especially here in the Charlotte area. They are all over town, including into some of our suburbs in Mecklenburg County. But there are 70,000 units that this impacts across the entire state.
And WSSC-TV spoke with a renter, Dante Brody, who lived in a Cortland property for 2 years and said that when they were raising the rent, he didn't think much about it because he just figured that's how Charlotte is. But he didn't like it.
Having to shell out that big expense of rent, being more than you want, is super inconvenient. But a lot of people can't stay in Charlotte. A lot of people got to go back home or move away somewhere cheaper just to save money.
So price increases are normal. At least that's been my experience over my life. It's normal, at least renewal time, for the price to go up, particularly in the inflationary environment in which we find ourselves today. But this has a legal component to it. Hunter, what is that legal component?
So basically, this lawsuit is arguing that these apartment property management companies were all turning to RealPage, which is a software company that was using an illegal type of algorithm where it took non-public information that these companies had, including occupancy, demand, all of their info, and then turned it into their own algorithm and then shared it. So it basically is alleging they conspired with one another. Instead of being competitive companies, they all have the same data so they could raise their prices. So in other words, if you're trying to look for an apartment, they're all going to have similar prices. So you're forced to pay a higher price.
Let me ask you why that's illegal. I just bought a piece of electronics. And every single place I shop for that precise piece of electronics, whether it was online or in a store here, it was the same price to the penny. What's the difference?
I'm no attorney, but I will just preface it with that. But what they are saying in this circumstance is that I think it's one thing to have a competitive market that allows those similar prices to happen. What they are alleging is that they all had the same information and were sharing that same information that was supposed to be privately held with each individual company in order to force the prices to be relatively the same.
Ben, you wanted to jump in here, I know.
What Jeff Jackson is arguing here, to put it in its most basic terms, this is like Mr. Graystar and Mr. Camden and Mr. Cortland all going to a bar and hanging out and sharing their information and say, hey, let's do this. Let's agree to this. That's the argument they're making, the sort of effect that RealPage with its algorithm, that's the argument they say it has, which is anti-competitive.
Mary?
Yeah, and it's interesting that Jeff Jackson, this is one of the first things he's bringing up, because he's proven that he's very adept at tech and all of these issues. And so that the fact that he's going at the fact that these people are, you know, using AI and these other tools to do this is quite interesting, because, you know, he's on top of all of this.
Yeah, he's not the only attorney general to be involved in this, however. He says that this practice bilked renters out of millions of dollars, but eight other states, including the Department of Justice, have joined in this suit, which originally targeted only RealPage, the software company. But Jackson and these other attorneys general have broadened the suit. Has there been any response from any of these corporations, Hunter?
We haven't gotten a response from any of them that we reached out to. I will say very quickly, Mike, it doesn't only impact renters. It also impacts the landlords who are actually following the rules and trying to, you know, either provide housing or their own income and business. So it's far reaching here.
So the Department of Justice is involved in this suit. Are they likely to stay involved after January 20th?
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think both sides, it has been an issue. Affordable housing clearly is an issue here. It's been a huge political point across the country. How I would see this happening, quite frankly, Mike, is settled with a huge payment and all these companies saying there was no wrongdoing.
It's been interesting that Trump ran as a populist, and so you would think he would be on the side of folks, you know, who are just trying to make a living. But he got, you know, look at his staff; it's full of billionaires. He got a lot of money from a lot of business people. So it'll, as Hunter said, it would be interesting to see how a new Justice Department balances all of these issues.
Ben.
Just real quickly, I want to say, because we did hear back from Graystar, in fairness to them, they said that at no time did they engage in any sort of anti-competitive practice, and that they look forward to vigorously defending themselves in court.
So the North Carolina Utilities Commission, Hunter, and the Department of Environmental Quality have both given Duke Energy permission to move ahead with plans to build new natural gas power plants in two counties, Catawba County being one of them. Gas was supposed to be a bridge between older, dirtier fossil fuels and new, cleaner energy. And so is this good news for environmentalists?
I think it's a step in, I don't know how to put this, I guess it's a step in the right direction from what everybody talked about in years past or decades past, but there is still some pretty big wedge of opposition to this as well. There's concerns about emissions that could be a problem here, as well as still trying to have the state not turn to more clean energy and still burning fossil fuels. So there was still a bit of opposition to this, but they did get the go-ahead on two plants.
Yeah, the Southern Environmental Law Center argues that these proposed gas plants will contribute significantly to local air pollution, but that they will be cleaner. But they will be cleaner, will they not, than natural gas? I mean, gas is different than, I mean, excuse me, cleaner than coal. Gas is cleaner than coal, correct? Or is it just different?
Yes, correct. But while gas plants would have lower sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide emissions, there's the argument that the coal burning facilities that they would replace, the air quality permit actually revealed that they're volatile organic compounds emissions that would increase with this new way.
I mentioned that natural gas power generation has been positioned by the energy industry, including Duke, as a bridge between older, dirtier fossil fuels and new, cleaner, renewable energy. But the SELC, the Southern Environmental Law Center, says building these facilities would lock the state into a future dependence on fossil fuels. Channel 9 reported that the state has a law mandating Duke Energy reduce CO2 emissions to 70% of 2005 levels by 2030 and to net zero by 2050, but that regulators have already approved a plan that misses the 2030 target by 5 years. Is that because these goals were or are unrealistic, or because there is a reluctance to meet these goals? Some foot dragging going on.
There could be both. I don't think it's any surprise of how much power Duke really holds in this state and in this region, whether it's with lobbying or whether it's with they're the largest dependent company for all of our energy source here. But I can't speak on if these markers were a little bit, you know, I guess to I can't speak on if they were a little bit, you know, if it was too promising or if people wanted to get there too quickly. But I think that it could be a bit of both.
So we talked last week on the Roundup about the contract between Charlotte Fire Department and Medic ending on January the 9th. That was yesterday. At the time, there was no deal to extend it, but CFD said back in July that they would no longer respond to medical calls unless new terms were negotiated. This week, there was movement. Hunter, what happened?
Yeah, so basically, there was a contract extension for 6 months. The good news here, Mike, is that there will be no changes to the public when you call 911 here in Mecklenburg County. But basically, Charlotte Fire last year in the summer sent this letter to Medic saying that it would not respond to medical calls unless there were new terms that were negotiated. So right now, Medic actually pays CFD annually in order to for CFD to respond to medical calls because they just don't have the resources for it. Yeah. We've grown and we are stretched thin in both departments.
Charlotte Fire Chief Reginald Johnson says the problem is coming from Charlotte's growth, which puts pressure on firefighters who are running 80,000 calls a year with four EMTs on each of the units. He says the reality is it comes down to resources and that the two organizations will spend the next 6 months now working toward a solution.
We have limited resources on both sides. Medic has limited resources. We have limited resources. And for the next 6 months, we're going to work to come up with an agreement that is collaborative and beneficial to both organizations.
That sounds very similar to what the fire department in Los Angeles is saying about their resources, their limited resources, which has hurt them in their ability to fight these outrageous fires, which are partly they're so unusual that no fire departments could fight these fires out there. But it canceled the Hornets game out there with the, was it the Clippers or the Lakers? It was the Lakers they were playing. So it canceled the game. They'll announce a new date for that game later on. The Panthers season, Mary, I know you want to talk about this, ended with a surprise 44-38 road victory over Atlanta with Bryce Young throwing three touchdown passes for a career high. What happened? Were the Falcons extraordinarily bad, or has he found his footing?
And he ran for two more. Well, the Panthers could no longer just blame it on the quarterback because after he was benched and came back, Bryce Young has been showing competence, looking like the Heisman Trophy winner from Alabama. The other thing it has pointed out, though, is he had to score 44 points to do it because the Atlanta Falcons scored 38, which leads. And there were several games they could have won at the end if they could have just held off the opponent. So they're going to need to work on that defense on the offseason. Probably Coach Dave Canales' job is safe. He won't have to worry about it. And they'll also be looking for an ace wide receiver because Adam Thielen keeps musing whether or not he will retire. So the prospects are good. They probably have their quarterback, but there are a lot of other parts of the game that they are going to have to surround him with some good, better folks.
And Panthers owner David Tepper called it a real good win and added, quote, "I think we've found our quarterback here." Good Lord, is he still making football decisions? Scott Fowler said that there's going to be not very much movement in the front office, and he questioned whether that's a good thing. Is it?
We'll see. We'll see what kind of moves they make in the offseason and how Bryce comes on strong next year.
Okay. Mary C. Curtis, our resident sports expert, columnist at rollcall.com, host of Equal Time, their podcast. Ben Thompson, an anchor at WCNC-TV. Hunter Sines, reporter for WSSC-TV. And Steve Harrison, our politics reporter for WFAE. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.